Are you looking for a podcast today with ornithology and humor you crave? Well, I know all these guys, and it's birds they like. It's Dirty Bird. Yeah, they're just a couple guys who really like birds. It's Dirty Bird. Yeah, they're pretty dirty, but they really like birds.
Hello, and welcome to Dirty Bird Podcast. Today, I have a very exciting episode. I'm doing my first interview with a book author, with Dr. Daniel Clem Jr., who recently wrote a book, Solid Air, Invisible Killer, Saving Billions of Birds from Windows. Dr. Daniel Clem, welcome to the show.
What a great privilege. Thank you very much, and really an honor to be able to talk to your audience.
Thank you so much for being here. We have a very serious topic to talk about today, but I know we'll definitely have fun with it too. Do you mind just introducing yourself for my listeners?
Of course not. I'm a professor of biology, and I have a special appointment. I'm the Sarcosuchopian professor of ornithology and conservation biology at a small college in southeastern Pennsylvania called Muhlenberg College. It's in Allentown, Pennsylvania. It's about an hour's drive to the northwest of Philadelphia. And I've been at this institution for 43 years. I came here right out of my doctoral program at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. And I've been very grateful for all the support they give me and the work that I've been able to do. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, of course. Do you mind telling us, I kind of ask everybody this question, what first got you into birding? How did you first get interested in these awesome creatures?
Right. I'm not sure that maybe your listeners do, especially if there are any professional ornithologists out there, but there's this, I don't know how you'd describe it, sort of qualification that when you get into your doctoral work, your committee wants to know, especially if you're in ornithology, that you really started watching birds when you were in the cradle. And I could never claim that. I came from an Eastern immigrant family, and we had no real formal education in our house. My parents, you know, their answer was go to the library or ask your teacher. Mm-hmm. I never really had the confidence, you know, to capture the attention of a mentor that would, you know, sort of take me under their wing as it goes.
Yeah.
But so I had an interest in the outdoors because many family members were outdoorsmen. You know, they were fishermen or hunters. I never was a hunter, but I spent my weekends and every waking opportunity being in the forest and walking the fields and enjoying really all wildlife. And so when I got this question, which I predictably was told it was coming in my examinations, I explained to them that I really didn't know about Roger Peterson and all those wonderful field guides, and that kind of resource wasn't really available to me. So I made up my own, right? I had my own field guide. I made up my own name for the birds. And later, of course, I was just surprised, as I shouldn't have been, that there's a long history of literature available on birds. But this got me through that question anyway. They accepted it. So I had a very early interest, again, from family interest in outdoors, and I followed along with that. And when I went to a local school to college, it was a small school, and most of the biology people were interested in medicine and other things. But I had an interest again in the outdoors, and it took me a while. So what happened was is that I saw the ocean at some point, you know, in my college career, and I fell in love with it. And it came time for my graduation, and I realized, like all biology people do, that unless you get some advanced training, your prospects of employment were pretty limited. You know, you might get lucky and be hired by a drug company to sell drugs, or you might work as a technician in a lab, you know, injecting rats or something of this nature. But I realized I wanted to do other things. And so I applied to a program because of the ocean and marine science. And I remember very vividly, you know, I had like 16 or so applications. And when I learned in the spring of 1968 that our government had cut out all opportunity for graduate study and I was going to be subject to the draft that ended my aspirations. So 15 letters went into the trash. One had already been sent. Much miraculously, I was accepted at Northeastern University in Boston. And
what are the chances?
Yeah. So I lucked out, and they agreed they would, you know, accept me after I had served my time in the service. And so when I came out, I planned on going there, but I met my wife in between there, and she didn't live in Boston. She lived in Long Island, and I looked for a program there, and it was there in a university that accepted me at Hofstra University. It's about 20 minutes outside of New York City, except, of course, with the traffic, then it might take you 3 hours. But there was a mentor there. There was an ornithologist, and he was keenly interested in getting students. And the marine science program wasn't really enthusiastically applied. So he asked me to study with him. I did, and I just became smitten. I read just about every book I could get my hands on. and so that got me started formally in ornithology.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. It's so cool how you kind of, you detail this in your book too, how you kind of just fell into it almost like it was fated to be. You know, you thought you were going to be marine biology, and then just, This became your passion.
Well, like, again, I think it's like with a lot of your listeners perhaps, right? I mean, it's not so much that you have these, you know, cemented plans about your future.
Right.
As much as it is guided and supported by someone who's actually interested in you as a person. And this was the first time that had happened to me. And I couldn't have been more grateful, right? And one of the tales I often tell is that I came back, you know, when I first started this ornithology class. And of course, as I said, I was swallowing all these books and field guides and things. And I'd been out in the potato fields in eastern Long Island. And I had seen what I had interpreted as a buff-breasted sandpiper. And, you know, again, they seemed like old friends to me because I'd been studying them, even though I was seeing them for the first time. And when I told my professor that, he said, oh, no, not likely. You know, they haven't been seen in 20, 30 years. And he says, well, what do they look like? And I explain it to him. And then he says, oh, let's go. So we got in his car. We drove out. Mercifully for me, I was able to find them again. And that, and that was the first time my name actually appeared in print. He gave me credit for discovering these birds after so many years. And it was in a journal, which doesn't exist now, but at the time it was pretty popular. It was called American Birds. And so I that was, again, just the beginnings. But later, you know, at the end of that training of my master's degree, I was attracted to Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. Southern Illinois actually has two universities. One's near St. Louis. It's in a town called Edwardsville. And then they have the bigger campus where they have a medical school and law schools and things like that. And I was enrolled in the zoology department there. And I was attracted because they had like a behavioral ecology program. And my intention was originally because I was keenly interested in behavior in a field called ethology, which is the biological study of behavior. And I wanted to use the prey catching methods of these different birds of prey and show how they evolutionarily were related, like with their form and function and other things. That was the motive to go there. But with political things and people leaving, again, a mentor there, the ornithologist, knew that, you know, I was thinking about leaving simply because the people who I came to study with were leaving. And he invited me to study with him. And when he did that, I was in his office one day. We were going to discuss topics. And he said, you know, very sort of anxiously and upset that he had a student who wouldn't collect the nest that he asked him to collect. And the reason he said was that he thought this was unethical and immoral. And he was upset with the student because the student lived in a home with his parents that were lavishly covered with glass, and they brought in 50 or 60 dead birds every year. But he never he never said to me that he thought that was unethical or immoral. Yeah. So he was, you know, ranting about this. And he turned to me and he says, well, you know, Dan, there might be something in this for you. And so the very next day, you know, I went to a building that he told me he had collected dead birds in front of. It was a glass facade on a chemistry building. And I sat there at dark, waited till it got light. A mourning dove came through the tree, smashed in front of me right in the glass and fell dead at my feet. And then I went looking on campus and found other evidence, and I was hooked. And so that's how I got, you know, interested in talking about this whole issue of as a conservation, an important conservation issue for birds and people, glass.
Right. And really, when you start to go into this problem in your book, it was really eye-opening for me. I mean, I think almost everybody has, you know, either witnessed a bird hitting a window or found a dead bird underneath a window. You know, it seems, oh, maybe it's just something that happens. But once you lay out the numbers, I mean, the big news items, you know, I think about like, you know, oil spills, you know, you see that and there's all the Dawn dish commercials with like, you know, them cleaning ducks. And like, that's what gets in the news for like, oh, this is a terrible ecological problem. People get excited about it, and there's laws passed and, you know, people get in trouble. But then the glass you lay out, like these oil spills, you know, it's a tragedy. There's, you know, thousands of birds that die. But when you lay out the numbers with the windows, I mean, it's like hundreds of millions minimum, upwards of a billion. That's just insane amounts of birds killed each year.
Yeah, I of course, I try to make the case for that. And, you know, in the book, I highlight, look at all of the avian mortality that's caused by human interactions. You know, we shouldn't be arguing about which one is the more important or, you know, we should be solving all of them.
That's true.
And like I point out, you know, like there may be a disproportionate number of, for example, birds of prey that we just talked about being killed at wind turbines, right, with their smaller populations and so on. And we should be dedicating our time and effort to solving that problem. But you're right, when you look, and this is a great deal of frustration for me, you know, when I would see national news, and even to this day, they're talking about, you know, in 1989 was the Exxon Valdez, and more recently the Deepwater Horizon down in the Gulf of Mexico. It's the oil spills that get to attention. But my earliest and my point is that scale does matter, even though we don't want to argue about which one we should be addressing. We should pay attention to scale. So if you look at the amount of birds that are dying at windows. In 1990, my first lowest estimate was 100 million annually in the U.S. alone. That takes 333 Exxon Valdezes every year.
Wow.
But like I point out, nobody's talking about windows. And now some more younger scientists, you know, that I'm very proud that I've attracted to this topic. The current range is 365 on the one side and over a billion on the other side. And that 365, even on the low side, is 1 million birds dying at glass every day in the United States alone. So it's a really horrific problem. Another issue, too, is people say, well, okay, if they're dying of that numbers, why don't we see them being, you know, taken away with dump trucks? And the answer is because they're so small and inconspicuous. And even when animals survive a strike, they hide themselves because of the way we place vegetation, you know, around our homes and everywhere. They get out of sight. And when you see this topic actually being covered, which is a relatively rare event by media, it takes place in cities, and mostly in cities simply because the birds are on sidewalks in front of glass windows and there's no place to hide, right? They're right in front of you. And people report, that's where reporters live in cities. And so you get some attention to this topic, but most of the dying is taking place at residences. Some of those young scientists that I told you about have recently looked in detail, and it turns out that about 44% of those deaths, those 1 billion deaths, for example, come from 1 to 3 story buildings, which are mostly human residences, right? Homes.
Right.
56% comes from commercial buildings or school buildings and so on, from 4 stories to 11. And where most of the attention in cities are getting this kind of concern, less than 1% actually the deaths are occurring at skyscrapers. And another thing too is that not to be diminished is our concern about the night lighting in cities, you know, in urban areas that reach into the sky. But even this is often misinterpreted, right? Most birds on night migrations, and a lot of birds, of course, migrate at night, are swarm warblers and vireos and thrushes and so on. And, you know, they're 2,500 to 5,000 feet. They travel over these cities on clear nights without any kind of influence or being drawn in to the danger zones. But when the ceiling is low, when the weather is bad, they're flying lower and the lights influence them. And like light, a moth to a flame, they're attracted to these lights. They swirl around in and out of the light beams. They're confused. They're not really hitting the windows. They're more likely to hit themselves, one another, than they are to hit the building. But they flutter to the ground exhausted. And now they're in the canyons of the glass and concrete. And here's where they get killed. And if the buildings were really striking them, you know, the people who go to look for them in the morning, you would predict that they would be found all over like rain on the street and the sidewalk. But where you find those birds in those cities are in front of the big glass windows, attempting to get at vegetation that's seen behind it or reflected in it.
Office plants and everything. Yeah.
So again, I think it's this deceiving quality. And of course, the main issue is, you know, why does it occur in the first place? And why it occurs in the first place is the birds behave as if the glass is invisible to them, right? They're trying to reach habitat seen on the other side of clear glass that's a barrier for them getting there, and the illusion of mirrored glass for the phasic habitat in sky. And like I like to point out to people, you know, when I get a chance to talk to them, we're not them, meaning we're not the birds that we never will be. So we have to rely on our ability to measure what their perceptive abilities are. You know, what do they see as best we can in terms of their accoutrements and so on, and then their behavior, you know? So who would argue that birds are flying into windows to kill themselves in a suicide-like fashion? Of course they don't. They're deceived, and they're through these illusions, and there's barriers that they're not able to determine. And so, you know, it's our job, because we created this problem, to solve it for them, to make it visible. And that's really what the book is about. The book is written for every citizen on the planet, because this particular topic is occurring around the world. Wherever there's a building with a piece of glass in it, or a window of any sort, you have the potential for a victim. And trying to solve this on a world scale is important, just to inform and to let people know that this exists, and that it's worth their time and effort to try to save these animals that have no voice for themselves and are not capable of defending themselves in any way. They relying on us.
Certainly. Yeah, I think all my listeners would agree with you there. And as far as I really like, you know, what you said, like we have to rely on, you know, what we can figure out about their visual systems. You do a great job in the book kind of walking us through your years of experimentation and some of the early on just figuring out, so can they really not see windows? Like, what's going on here? And it's really incredible that no, they can't. Like a sheet, a pane of glass is, it might as well just be air. The whole premise of your title to a bird. And this was a real head scratcher to me, because through doing this podcast, I've kind of, you know, amateur researched birds a lot, and bird bodies and bird eyes in particular. You have a whole section talking about bird eyes. Most bird species I cover, I try to see if there's any studies, you know, looking into the differences in their eyes between species. Each have certain adaptations, but I mean, bird eyes are incredible. They can see, you know, more colors than us. They have the oil droplets that cause who knows what kind of facets of color they see there. They have the multiple foveas for increased visual acuity. It's just so mind-boggling that something that, you know, we can see and perceive that they just can't see with all their, you know, depth of vision. They somehow, this is just a natural deficit for them.
I think it's important that all the things that you mentioned are fascinating, in the sense that with all of their additional tools to look at the world with greater clarity, with greater range of color abilities, and with an ability to look at the landscape as best we do. You know, we look at something, we look straight at it, it looks the clearest to us, and we look to the side, we see, you know, our peripheral vision. It's because our cells and the way they're distributed. But birds have, and again, not all are the same, but most of them have a great deal of concentration of those cells that are perceiving the electromagnetic waves that come into their eyes. And so we judge, just about all of them have a much more clearer field of view. But still, with all of that favored improvements in the backbone eye, birds, of course, of all animals having backbones, have the best vision. They still can't see glass. And we can't either. Most people, of course, and, you know, there's been some physicians that work in emergency rooms that have contacted me that are interested in this topic, you know, and they mentioned You know, people have been killed walking in the glass, but it's a very, very rare event. Most times they're not paying attention, right? They're talking to a colleague,
just bonk
or
your head.
they've just picked up a cup of coffee. You know, there's even things on the internet. You can see some what people think are funny, you know, walking in the glass and spilling the coffee all over them. But most of us are cognizant of the context in which the glass is in, right? It's got a sill, it's on a door. But these guys, it just takes a small, tiny window, like in the small garage, that can deceive them. And they die there as horribly as they do in an entire building, like that chemistry building that's an entire facade of glass. It doesn't really matter.
Right.
So size of the glass doesn't matter. The big thing about trying to predict, you know, who's killed where and what numbers, I like to describe is like within the first 10 meters or 30 feet of the glass surface. I call that the danger zone. That's where the bird is in a position to be deceived by trying to see habitat on the other side of clear panes, like in an atria or a corridor or something of this nature, or the illusion. And, you know, what brings them into that danger zone helps to explain how many birds get killed and in, you know, which ways. And that's largely predictable. Many of my studies have revealed on the basis of the attractants, like vegetation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or watering areas, and or in the case of homes, bird feeders that are in front of them. I like to tell the tale about a colleague, Dick Banks was his name. He worked at the Smithsonian Institution, a wonderful and brilliant scientist. And he would leave his Virginia home and he'd take the metro into his office at the Smithsonian, the museum there. And he, as they often are doing, you know, they're building another building on the Washington, D.C. Mall. And this particular one had a glass facade all along its length. And as he walked in front of it, because he was conscious and interested in this issue about the birds and glass, he would pick up victims of strikes, right, striking the window almost randomly along his walk of this building. Then they planted, maple trees every 30 feet. And when he did that same walk, he only found the birds in front of the maple trees. Now, I'm sure your listeners have heard this, right? And I joke about it all the time. You know, I don't know why they don't use ornithologists, but they're always talking about, you know, important issues and making decisions and being able to figure things out and being a rocket scientist, right? But it doesn't take a rocket scientist or an ornithologist to figure this out, right? The birds are being attracted to the trees. They see another tree in the mirror. They're trying to get to that and they get wet.
That,
So that helps to explain, you know, why he was able then to have his searches be a little more concentrated wherever the trees were.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it really, you know, really makes you think. I have seen stuff where American Bird Conservatory or Audubon Society, you know, they'll tell people, you know, move your feeders back like 30 meters. I was a little disheartened when I read your book. You know, it said you had done experiments trying to see, is there any actual data on this? And found that really it doesn't matter about the distance, just
right.
even the fact that it's there. So really, that you know, this issue can really only be solved by the you know changing the windows themselves, changing the way that we have our houses with our windows. And I definitely want to get into some of those solutions a little bit later on, listeners. If there's some downer stuff, I want you to be hardened later on in the show, because there are pretty simple solutions for helping to prevent this, along with some more complicated and futuristic and some really cool stuff. But I also want to talk a little bit more about what happens to a bird when it strikes a window. Because I really, you know, as a physician, I really was interested in the pathophysiology of what happens when a bird strikes. Everyone just, I guess, common sense, you would think, oh, well, they snap their neck. But you kind of show, no, it's a lot different than that. Do you mind talking about that a little bit?
Oh, no, of course not. But it's a good segue. I want to point out about that issue about where you place your bird feeders, because I think that's really, really important. It turns out that if you have your feeder within 1 meter, like 3 feet or less from your window, it seems counterintuitive, but you're saving bird lives by doing that, because the birds come and go to the feeder and they don't really build up enough momentum to hurt themselves should they brush against your window or be deceived. And people have written, you know, popular writers, I see this regularly, even to this day. And in fact, on some of those high image organizations that you mentioned, they actually have a description that says, you know, place your feeder within 3 meters of the surface or greater than 30 feet. And, you know, the 33 feet thing only was the limitations of my experiment. It had nothing to do with saving more bird lives. You know, the, like you said, there is no real safe distance away from the window if the birds have an opportunity to enter that danger zone, you know, that 10 feet, or I'm sorry, that 30 feet area, 10 meters in front of the window. So if you place your feeders away, and the reason why 30 feet sticks in people's mind is that in that paper that I wrote about, I didn't think anybody would put a feeder greater than 30 feet because they want to see the birds, right? So I just stopped the experiment there. It wasn't because that was the safety zone. But again, what happens is that a bird that is a meter away from a window, like a sparrow, you know, even a house sparrow or a house finch or a dark-eyed junco, I mean, they can build up enough momentum to kill themselves outright right at that window that's in front of them. Just 1 meter. So getting the feeder closer would be helpful. And so what happens when they hit, you know, if somebody picks up a bird that was freshly killed in front of a window, they almost invariably interpret that bird, that victim of dying of a broken neck, simply because the neck itself is so flexible. The kind of articulating surfaces that are associated with the cervical vertebrae, the bones of the neck in a bird, are saddle-shaped. They're even given a special name. They're called heterocoelous vertebrae. And they, as opposed to ours, which are called acoelous, which are flat. But in birds, this particular shape, saddle shape, facilitates the movement of the neck in a very fluid and open way. And so when a bird is really, really freshly killed, it looks like its neck is so pliable that it died as a result of a broken neck. But I've literally x-rayed thousands of birds. None of them that I've ever x-rayed had a broken neck or a cervical fracture. What birds do die from, however, is just like with humans, right? And as a physician, if somebody gets hit in a car accident out on the highway and they're fortunate enough or they, you know, traumatize their head, they've hit so hard, and the helicopter comes to take them to the emergency room, they'll cut the top of their head off so that the edema, the brain will swell, and it'll then shrink, and then they'll suture them back up. And if they don't do that, of course, they'll break the blood-brain barrier and they'll typically perish. And this is what happens with birds. There's nobody to aid them in permitting the swelling of the brain. And again, if your listeners don't know, you know, if you wanted to think about the consistency of the tissue of a brain, it's about the consistency of a banana. So if you squeeze a banana, it's like squeezing your brain tissue. And having your brain smushed inside your cranium to one side and traumatizing it, and then having it respond by trying to swell and expand itself, and there's nowhere to go, this is what causes the problem. In my collection of information over many, many years, right, because my studies in my doctoral program, which what this topic was all about, ranged from 1974 to 1979, I had cooperators that lived at their homes and worked at their homes. So we numbered all their windows. We were able to record every strike and what happened to them. And so one out of every two strikes on both these homes that were monitored from 1.5 to 2.5 years resulted in an outright death. 50% of them flew away. And we suspect that they flew away, you know, and then later succumbed just because of the kind of injuries we were able to monitor from those that you know, did come outcome. And one of the dramatic events that took place was from one of my cooperators who had this huge plate glass wall in his home, and he had a field in front of him, a lawn, right, which was gone wild. He didn't really maintain it in terms of cutting, but he watched a pileated woodpecker, you know, a woodpecker the size of a crow, fly like a football field, 100 meters, 300 feet away, 300 yards away from that edge of that field towards him. And as he stood in front of that window, that bird struck the glass right in front of him.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And thinking about it, right? So how would that happen? Well, because that bird interpreted, right, the reflection of that field to continue right into the glass, just like those maple trees before. But it was wintertime. And that beautiful bird, you know, when it struck, its tongue ejected. And woodpeckers, again, for your listeners, they have very long tongues, right? So it stuck to the glass, and the bird survived the strike, but ripped its tongue off as it flew away.
Oh my gosh.
So trying to, you know, conceive of that poor animal trying to survive without a tongue after that is, I think, expecting too much. And I've got, you know, in the book, you've seen it already. There's a series of white-throated sparrows that I've taken a picture of. And it shows, for example, superficially, when you take the skin away from the top of the skull, massive amounts of hemorrhaging on one extreme. On the other extreme, you could hardly see any hemorrhaging. But every one of those birds died outright when it hit that window. So injuries, and I try to bring in the chapter that talks about this issue, the work of rehabilitators who have also looked at the kinds of injuries. And unlike, you know, my findings where they did find some birds that had cervical fractures, they did find, you know, air sacs that were punctured. They did find coracoid and clavicle bones. In birds, of course, the clavicle is fused. We refer to it as the wishbone. But they found evidence of this, you know, not very much, but some. Mm-hmm. But take a rocket scientist, an ornithologist could figure this out too. And that is that when you're traveling, you know, 15, 20, 25 miles an hour, as many passerines do, when they strike these windows, anything's possible depending on the angle in which they make their impact.
Right. That's a very important point to make about the wildlife rehabilitators. I've actually had a veterinarian at a wildlife rehabilitation in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia on the show before. And we briefly touched upon this issue. You know, as you write in the book and as she said in the show, really the majority of those birds that even fly off from that the window strikes are going to die. And so it's very important that if you can, you know, safely contain them within a cardboard box or something to get them to a wildlife rehabilitator so they at least have some kind of chance. And I just have to share an experience I had that, like, oh gosh, you know, after learning this, it kind of ruined it for me. But I was studying in a at an academic center, and of course they had one of those halls just like that chemistry building with, you know, all glass, you know, looks very, you know, pretty for I don't know the investors at the university, but terrible for birds. And a ruby-throated hummingbird struck the window right near me, and you know, and so of course, you know, I examined it, and it still appeared to be like breathing and everything. So I like cupped it in my hands for a while to kind of like warm it, I guess. And then I felt its little wings going and opened up, and it flew away. And I was like, oh, you know, it was just stunned. It'll be okay now. Now knowing that fact, it's like, nope, I should have brought it somewhere, because, you know, it probably flew off and it probably had like a slow subdural hematoma going on that then just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it perished.
Yeah.
So yeah, it just really points out that, I mean, these are death traps. And even if it appears that the bird's okay after hitting them, the survival rate is very, very low. And even if they would survive, there's probably some dazed period, and they're very susceptible to predation, especially by cats.
For sure. Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that it's important for us to bring up in our conversation is that I claim, because of the kinds of evidence we've been able to gather regarding the health of the victims and what's happened to them, that, you know, unlike what other wildlife people might describe as compensatory mortality associated with us humans or other natural causes like starvation or disease or something. And they call it compensatory mortality because it's presumed that the populations are able to recoup, you know, they're able to build back. But this particular issue, given the nature of how the birds can't perceive the threat, it's indiscriminate. And it takes the strongest as well as the weakest. And I have and I'm sure you read this in there, there was an indigo bunting that was, you know, flew into a window in the spring in the Halton region in Ontario, and it happened to be the home of a bird bander, right? So this guy put the bird, like you described, in a quiet place in a box. It seemed to recover completely after being out cold for 30 minutes at least. And when it seemed to recover completely, he put the band on it, he released the bird. That bird presumably went on either in that local area or slightly north and was a successful breeder and returned to Central and South America for its non-breeding season. 1 year to the day, it hit the very same window in the very same house and killed itself outright. So this was an example of an animal that seemingly recovered, continued to breed, but then succumbed without knowing. And that also reminds me of In the book, I describe and even show some pretty grisly pictures where American kestrels would get into houses.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and they would get down, you know, because they leave the...
That was heartbreaking, that part.
Yeah, but you know, the point about that is that when these birds would get down into these houses, in the main part of the house, and they'd get into these rooms, the compelling vision of their habitat through that clear window, it was so powerful. They couldn't they couldn't reason anything else and couldn't understand why they couldn't get with it, get to it. And so you found their bodies emaciated and smudged windows just repeat. What a horrible death.
Yeah.
And they never really could, you know, go. And I use that, you know, not to make fun, but I also point out that's like people who ignore, right? Or they feel they don't believe, you know, the kind of evidence that I've tried to provide in this book, which
that's
I think is overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, they're just blinded by their prejudice about thinking that this is not possible. And we didn't talk about it, you know, but it does bear mentioning that if you look at when I finished my dissertation work, I thought what I found was so novel and exciting that the scientific community, the peer-reviewed publications would be fighting to get my work. But it took me 10 years to convince them. They would always turn my papers back saying it was unsuitable. And I use this as an example in a book because there's I can't remember the author's name right now, but it was a woman and she wrote this wonderful treatise on extinction. And she pointed out that a big debate during Darwin's time was, you know, whether animals became extinct because of catastrophes, which was the reigning view, you know, like with the biblical flood and so on. And then on the other extreme, uniformitarianism, slow changes that eventually, through natural selection, resulted in their demise because of competition or other changes. And it was the uniformitarianism that won out during that day. But when we reflect back on that, most of these big ticket items and questions that we ask about is neither either or. It's typically a combination. It's a more complex explanation. And so there's lots of evidence now that we have catastrophes that can cause extinctions, as well as we have the uniform degradation of populations over time. And my point in bringing that up is that perhaps, and I write this in the books, perhaps those editors that kept on sending my manuscripts back telling me that the topic was unsuitable is that they just didn't believe it. You know, it was something that they themselves were not familiar with or perhaps didn't really think about or encounter. And so to accept the claims that I was making, no matter how important and objective I thought the science was, I guess was a little bit too much for them. That did change. And now I'm happy to report again, there are lots of, especially much younger scientists who have turned their attention to this. And like I like to point out, you know, not to be in any way egotistical about it, but of all the studies that have been done since my fundamental published works, I think, again, nobody has found any major errors. The fundamental findings are consistent, right? The birds behave as if they're invisible. They die in these huge numbers, and it's our, you know, job to make sure that we care for them. But I think that that's a very, very important lesson, right? In all science, you build a mousetrap. The person who had the one before is forgotten, and the one that has the better one is remembered. And so I like to point out to everybody, you know, not that it matters to anybody but me, but I haven't been completely forgotten yet. So the cause is still worthy and I'm still at it.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And I mean, your findings have stood up to the test of time too. I just could not help but think that our windows, like our future generation is going to look at windows the way that now we look at like DDT and Freon as these like very obviously terrible things that were decimating birds and just took like some laws to change. And then, you know, birds were fortunately, you know, you think of like the bald eagle able to rebound after that and, just really hoping that this is a situation here. And another thing that you point out in the book too is, that these big windows, I mean, they're a relatively new thing. For so much of human history, most of our glass was, you know, very small or like colored or, you know, these big, clear, giant windows covering every surface. You know, now that they're cheap and affordable enough to put everywhere. So this is kind of a new thing. And I couldn't help but think about, there's so many bird species that I've studied for the show. And it's a very, like, when I look into their population declines, because almost every single one is declining. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, you know, it's very multifactorial. It's not, you know, super sure. Of course, we can say habitat loss, pollution, that kind of stuff. And I'm like, you know, I'm wondering about windows too. Like, that seems to be probably another major factor too.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure your guests were, you're from your own reading. You read not too long ago, like in 2019, I wasn't party to this very distinguished Cabo group of scientists that in our most prestigious scientific journal in North America, anyway, Science, they mm-hmm. published a report where 3 billion individual birds have been lost to the North American bird population since 1970 to the present. And that's 29%. And mm-hmm. A good, you know, principal cause of that mortality, it turns out, is windows. Sure, cats are in there for sure. And that's another mm-hmm. thing, you know, I don't, you know, again, I'm not interested in downplaying us. We have to keep our cats indoors. We have to watch them. Again, the cat numbers are compromised because other studies that I've done, it's not just been dogs and cats, it's been raccoons and squirrels and chipmunks and and all these animals. They learn that there's food to be had below windows, and they collect mm-hmm. the dead and dying. And that's another major reason why you don't see a lot of these animals in front of windows, because the scavengers get there first. But I like to point out, you know, I mean, we don't have the data yet, but I predict, you know, it won't be long before our window numbers, as tragic as they are, they're going to get a little bit more objective attention. Because if you think about it, just using a little common sense, right? Cats are like other predators. They're taking the vulnerable animals, right? They're the less fit members of the population. The windows are taking both the strongest as well as the weakest.
Right.
And if you think about the built environment around the world, there's astronomically more surface area of glass than there are cats. And so putting these two little, you know, bits of pieces together, you get the impression that the windows, for sure, are an unbelievably horrific threat that we need to address to make them safe.
Right. And why should people care about it? Beyond, like, you make a great case for this, too, the whole chapter dedicated to it, some really good points. Like, of course, for us, you know, nature lovers, bird lovers, I mean, you would hope that people are moved. I don't want to kill a creature, you know, especially in my home, my nice home with my garden and bird feeders. You would hope they would want to do everything they can to stop killing birds. But you also go beyond that because you're like, all right, if this isn't enough to appeal, then how can I appeal to people? And one of the things you just mentioned too, I mean, those dead birds are going to be attracting scavengers. You don't want, you know, a lot of those, you know, varmints coming that close to your house because you're basically feeding them with your windows. And then you go into probably the most stirring argument for a capitalist society is the economics of birds, just how much birds contribute to our economy. They're tens of billions worth of pest control, free pest control. And then there's all the birding jobs that are supplied. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, not to mention just the keystone species that many birds are in the environment. Like this is a problem that is not just like, you know, bleeding heart helping the birds that we should solve. We should solve it to help ourselves too. And I think that really helps kind of make the case that this is a very, very important issue.
I try to spend some quality time describing the services that birds provide us. And of course, what you're alluding to is they take care of the pests in the boreal forest, you know, the spruce budworms and so on. Mm-hmm. And there are scavengers, you know, the vultures and others have provided us with a great deal of service that otherwise we would be more under the pressure of rabies and other things that would otherwise mm-hmm. show up in the population. The nuts and the seeds that are planted to recoup, you know, our environment, all of these things are of value. But what you allude to, of course, is that if your listeners are maybe unaware of this, every 6 years or so, our national government produces a report and it describes how much money is spent on avocation. And every time, gardening comes out number one. And second, is always birding. And it's not, again, when you think about that, right, it's not just the birds themselves. They're talking about what money is spent on people buying binoculars or books, or they're talking about many states, for example, like New Jersey and Texas and Louisiana. They have birding trails and people for lodging and for meals and all these things that would be attractive, like for any sporting event or any avocation that people might have. All of these things. And then, of course, the other thing that you're alluding to is that birdseed alone is a multi-billion dollar industry in addition to all these other things. So yeah, there's plenty to think about. And if you're, again, just economically or money oriented, there's enough there too to justify our attention to saving these animals.
So let's dive into it. Let's talk about how to solve this problem. Part of what I really liked about your book too is it was your journey. It has a very very coherent flow where you kind of talk about one, discovering this is an issue, then kind of researching why it happens that birds just can't see the windows. You start really researching into solutions for it. And it was a really cool kind of journey to take along with you in the book, as you kind of reach the end of the book, getting more like finding solutions. And there's a lot of stuff that happens with that. But some of the easiest solutions, and this is put out by like the Audubon Society a lot, and you mentioned it, the 2x4 rule or the handprint rule for just covering up the windows with some kind of tape or dots, something that is separated by it's 2 inches horizontally and 4 inches vertically. Do I have that right or backwards?
No, you have that right. You have that right. And again, today though, some of the discussion has been to try even to, although the 4 inches work, it reduces the strike of a bird by 95 to 100% in some of my experiments. Reducing it to 2 inches horizontally and vertically is expected to protect more of the smaller birds, like those hummingbirds that you talked about earlier, or kinglets, right? And so if you can deal with this, and again, I always like to describe how when I first started studying this, some of the most ardent, I mean, we're talking about very, very distinguished conservationists said to me, Dan, you go mucking around with the way I look out my window and you're going to lose, meaning they weren't going to pay any attention to it. Nobody else was either. Well, I'm happy to report that within the last 5 to 10 years, that's changed because people are beginning to see, at least those that look into the issue, how horrific and the carnage that's taking place. And they've been willing to make these changes. Regarding solutions, I typically break it down into two levels, short term and long term. Short term solutions really refer to having to retrofit the rest of the world, right? Everybody, all the windows out there now are killing birds. We have to make them safe. And so this is where the tapes, or here's where the decals that are being at very reasonable prices available to be placed on windows. There's a group in Toronto called Feather Friendly that sells this stuff. It's now getting as far away as New Zealand and Australia and in Europe. Very big success. There's another colleague and person, Copian Bird Savers. These are paracord strings that you put in front of your windows, and they're separated by 4 inches vertically. Very cheap to make. You can make them yourself. You can he will even make them for people who don't have the facility to do it. And there's a tape called Kaleidoscape. It's a one-way film that you see like on buses for advertising. It's made by 3M company. Well, 3M doesn't sell that particular film for reasons other than advertising. And but it's so durable that it's been on the Toronto Zoo for over 14 years and still doing a job of protecting birds. But what they do is they sell it to other people. And there's a company called Kaleidoscape. It's available on Amazon, and you can buy this stuff from them, and you get, again, to see out of your window from the inside, but the outside, it protects the birds because it transforms your window into something that they can see and avoid. Now, the big thing to remember about these retrofits or really any other installation is that unless you're dealing with a see-through effect, like a corridor or an atria or a railing around a building or an apartment or something or a parking lot, the application has to be on the outside of the window. Has to be what they call surface number one. And again, if it's a see-through effect, It could be on any surface, really, as long as the birds and humans see it. But 99% of most window installations create a reflection. Even a perfectly clear window will act like a mirror on the outside if it's covering a darkened space. And so you have to make these decals or these tapes or whatever you use, strings, you're going to have to put them on the outside of your window to be effective, right? So that's very, very important. The other major category I describe as the long-term solution. That's like building a bird-safe building from the get-go, right? Putting in glass, novel glass that's bird-safe. There's a group in Montreal called Walker Glass.
Walker Glass.
They have a whole brand called AviProtect, and their visual patterning is the result of acid etching, and they have what I call the elegant solution, pattern glass that uses ultraviolet that birds see and we don't, and it transforms the window into a barrier. But to be certain, the ultraviolet patterning, you know, is not as effective as the actual visual ones. Mm-hmm. You know, the visual ones will knock down the strike rate by, you know, 95 to 100%. But the ultraviolet, we haven't gotten to the point, it's still a work in progress, of being able to produce those signals so it does the same thing. Now it reduces the strike rate by about 70%. Still a lot, better than nothing for sure. People mm-hmm. always ask me, you know, what should be the level of protection for a window? You know, for me, anything above nothing is helpful, right? But in Europe, for example, there are some laws in Austria that have been passed. It has to be over 90% effective. But in our country, we don't have that now. We have a tough enough time getting people to do anything with their windows, right? Just to inform them about the issue. And that's where you alluded to earlier, where we really need to have our legislation, our law enforcement, our legislation to make our buildings safe, you know? It's like, I always like to use the example, right? What happened when seatbelts came out? You know, even when they first came out, before they were legislative to be mandatory, people didn't use them and they died, right? I mean, they died because mm-hmm. they didn't use a seatbelt. And many of the tragedies to this day, I'm sure that you're aware of, you know, that show up in emergency rooms and so on, are people that aren't accidents that they didn't have their seatbelts on. But now it's a law. And so people are waiting for people to voluntarily make their building safe, I think is expecting too much. And where we have national laws and actually regional laws like states and provinces to address this issue, you know, they're so complicated. Because think about it, we have a national law that protects all birds in North America, except for a handful of species that have been introduced, right? So that means that if we are involved, according to those that interpret the law, of unintentional as well as intentional deaths of these animals, which would include windows, right? We're all guilty. And I would argue, you know, with the Fish and Wildlife Service, whose job it is to enforce this thing, I would tell them over the years, okay, look at, we don't want you or anybody else to be in a position to have to arrest every citizen in the United States, myself included. But how about McCormick Place in Chicago, where it kills, 200 a day? Don't you think you ought to be doing something about that? So what's happening lately is, and there's, as you well know, there's a whole chapter in the book that talks about the legal issues and, and protecting them. And the whole deal there is to point out that a lot of emphasis is being made on municipalities now. So cities yes. like New York and Toronto, and even smaller ones like Oak Park in California and so on, they're passing laws to make sure that their architects and their developers are going to be building bird-safe buildings. We want to see that spread, you know, to help the animals. There's a whole chapter also in the book which talks about advocacy or what can citizens do. And I give a letter in there, you know, to send to a legislator, to send to a reporter, to send to an architect or a developer, introducing them with the issue and saying that this is worth your time and effort. And then a whole other example of what an ordinance might look like, right, for a town. Mm-hmm. I give practical examples. So I'm hopeful that that'll be helpful to those that want to join the common cause in saving these animals.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I loved that part. When I came across that, I was like, yes, because it's literally fill in the blank. So, I mean, you can't make it easier than that for people to look, like, if you're passionate about this, here you go, like, get started. Mm-hmm. That Walker Glass is pretty awesome. I went on their website and it's really, they have some really beautiful patterns too that they have. So like, it's not just that you're oh, this is something I have to do to protect the birds. It's you're adding aesthetically to your house. I think they're mostly more commercial, but a commercial business would be adding like aesthetically to their building by using this acid etched glass. I don't know if there's any architects out there listening too, but if you're starting to work on a building, this is certainly something to bring up. It's certainly a big issue, but start at the local level for sure. But you know, hope for the best as far at the national level, and certainly something that we need to advocate about.
Yeah, I was going to mention. I'm not sure that your listeners may know about this. It was new to me. One of the other glass companies in the United States that I've been working with have gotten research grants and trying to determine whether their products are going to be effective or not is a company called Guardian Glass. And when I went to visit them in Michigan, Carlton, Michigan, they gave me a tour of their plant. And what was so appealing and just eye-opening for me was that I knew before I went there that there was only a handful, really, of manufacturers like Guardian that make glass from scratch, right? From oxygen and sand and silicon and so on. And their plant did that. And I got to see that. That was fascinating. And those companies, those handful of companies that make this, they sell them to thousands upon thousands of other glass manufacturers like Walker and others around the world that put their own individual creativity to the glass that they're selling. But this Guardian especially and Walker have invested in this issue to try to make architects and new buildings bird safe from the beginning. So they need to be pat on the back, you know, they need to be thanked for their efforts.
Yeah, no, that's so good to see companies that are actually interested in, you know, helping with an issue like this and are invested in it. But kind of as you go into in your book too, even though these companies that, you know, you had great discourse with about this problem, like at a certain level, you know, there has to be demand for it, you know, for the companies to even no matter how much they may, you know, philosophically want to be involved in it, like they're a business. So you know, we have to, you know, as citizens, drive the demand for that. It definitely is heartening. You know, through the book, there were a lot of heartbreaking moments. You definitely do a great job building the case for why this is such a big problem. But it was really nice, you know, at the end, getting uplifted a bit, knowing, hey, there's solutions. There's easy, cheap ones I can do. There's, you know, big ones that, you know, we need to advocate the laws for. And then you help provide a lot of resources to help with solving this.
Yeah, I'm reminded that someone read my book and said, oh, especially your chapter 8, Dan, it sounds like a novel. And I guess I took that as a compliment. I don't think they meant it, you know, that way for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But the other part was, I said, if you really were upset about not seeing, you know, sort of the hard scientific language being used in a rather structured way, you could go to the bibliography, which is about 30 pages, right?
So, it is. So yes, it was. I was very impressed.
There's plenty of science back there, and they can spend the rest of their days looking at that. The one thing that I could share too with your readers is that, you know, the technical people that read my book, right, other scientists that were looking at facts and figures and all that kind of thing, they said, you know, Dan, you have to end this with something. And they already informed me something that I was planning on doing. And that is, as you described, you know, leaving the reader with saying something very, very positive. You know, it's not a downer. And I say in the very beginning of the book, you know, this could be a really grim issue, but there is there is some levity in here if you're open for it.
And, oh, yes.
And the biggest thing is the outlook is good, really. I said, you know, this isn't climate change that's sort of existential or so complex that the constituencies and the whole national level has to commit for us to expect to get something positive out of this. This is a problem we could solve tomorrow. We just need the will, right? And so the idea that I came up with? And the idea I came up with in ending the book was to say, now, to try to put this thing in perspective, and let's leave on a positive note, think about a population that's losing, you know, its members. And the members of the population cannot conceive why this is happening. You know, their leaders are being lost. Their neighbors are being lost. Their schoolmates, they're disappearing, and they're clueless. And they don't sort of get upset or anything. They just don't understand it. They can't comprehend what this loss means or how it's happening. And then we have an alien that visits the population, and they can see what the population can't see. Right? They can see the invisible force that's causing these losses, and they're able to fix it. And I say in the book, you know, read the windows as the invisible force taking the victims and the individuals of the population. Read us humans as the saviors who can see the problem and can solve it. We just need the will to do it. And it is something we can't solve. And it's a really, I think, a very, it can be a very, very feel-good story and a good ending. But first of all, what you're trying to do and what I'm very grateful for is we've got to get the word out. People have got to be convinced that this is worth their time and energy and effort. And these animals are worth it. You know, again, I say, like just about every conservationist does, right? Do you want a world for our children without birds? I don't think so, right? They offer so many things. If you just take, you know, forget about the economics, the aesthetic capture of the birds and the images and the imagination that they bring to human beings at all levels of whether it's poetry or literature or whether it's actual science is so overwhelming. We can't really conceive of a world without them. Even if you don't pay any attention to them, they enter your life, whether you like it or not. And I think for the good, for the most part. So it's our responsibility to solve this problem that we created for them, one that they don't understand or can't comprehend.
So true. So true. And it gives me just a good feeling too, that whole fact, like this is something we can solve. This is something we can do. We know the solutions. It's not, we just have to have the will. We have to spread the word. And we can certainly do that. One more thing I want to talk about just before I end the show is, to just also, you know, ended on an even more of a positive note is, you know, I thought it read like a novel in a good way, in the fact that you get some character development through the book over this, you know, decades long journey that you do in researching and helping figure out solutions to this problem. You know, some of my like favorite, you know, moments are like when you have these little like snafus with people. But at one point you referenced yourself as the Robbie Dangerfield of ornithology, which I thought was like the most hilarious thing I had read. Rodney Dangerfield, sorry. Like I just like could not just pictured you going like, I researched birds hitting glass, I get no respect.
That came about because of a writer, a reporter, a freelance writer in Baltimore who taught a journalism class at Loyola College, right? And she asked her journalism class, hey, I've just discovered this guy who seems to be crying in the wilderness about his topic about birds. Do you think it's worth my time to look into it and write an article? And they all agreed, and she came up and she spent a day with me. And I think I can't be certain, but I think she was the one who said, you're the Rodney Dangerfield. Of course, today, with so many young people, you know, and poor Rodney has passed away now. And so his humor, you know, isn't in our face as much as it used to be. But having to explain to people that was his line, right? I get no respect. You know? So yeah, that happens. And yeah, you just keep plugging away.
Yep, exactly. That's all you can do, right?
I think one of the other things I'm sure you came upon, hope you enjoyed it, was a quote by Calvin Coolidge, right? Not really often thought of as our Abraham Lincoln or George Washington in terms of stature of presidencies, but he had this description of what it takes, you know, to solve problems. And it isn't genius, you know, there's a lot of geniuses that never really do anything with it. And they're not education. There's a lot of people that are educated. And he says, it's really what it's all about is sort of like what Teddy Roosevelt said, it's persistence, staying with it. And that's the whole thing. I got a call one time from a young man from Oregon. He wanted to compliment me on taking over for doing the work that my father had begun. And I explained to him, well, you know, my dad was a barber and he made me get a barber's license before he'd let me drive the family car. He wanted to make sure that I had something to do when I flunked out of school, if that happened. And so I can't really, you know, identify my dad as being related to this bird window issue. So what you're reflecting on is just the fact that I've been doing this for so long that it looks like I've got two or three generations under my belt, but it's just me, just keep plugging along. And then the other thing that when I think about it, when I'm giving talks, you know, in person, I'm reminded of a woman, Rebecca Kreshkov. Rebecca contacted me when the World Trade Center, before the World Trade Center was destroyed, it killed a lot of birds flying into the windows. And she was able to get and involved me in the discussions with the building manager to put netting up to protect the birds, right? So a few years ago, she called me and she says, you know, Dan, this is still a worthy cause, and I'm so grateful that you're continuing to study it. But I got to share with you, and I hope this doesn't upset you. I got to share with you that you're going to be long dead before anybody really does anything meaningful about this.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And so I end the talk by saying, I'm still hoping she's wrong. And the window is closing, you know, not to be too metaphoric about it, but the window is closing. And I'm still hoping that things will happen for the better before it shuts all the way on me.
Well, like you said, we could solve this problem tomorrow. So just keep sticking around.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you.
Oh, no. Well, thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for writing this book. So for my listeners, again, the title is Solid Air, Invisible Killer, Saving Billions of Birds from Windows by Dr. Daniel Clem Jr. And you can find this book, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever, you know, you get books. But I would encourage you to look for it on HancockHouse.com. That's the publisher of the book, because if you buy it through there, it's all recycled paper. So, you know, let's save birds. Let's save the environment, too. Any closing remarks, Dan? Anything else that I missed?
I think just to remind everybody, right, that these animals that we adore so much, they really are innocent, and their deaths are unintended and unwanted. And we need to wrap our heads around the responsibility to stop that, right, to make sure that they survive and that we're enjoy not only ourselves, but generations into the future. And I couldn't be more grateful for the privilege and opportunity of talking with you on your podcast, and hoping that your listeners can wade through it and get some really positive, because that's what it's all meant to be, positive, not negative.
Right.
Grateful, very, very grateful. Thank you very, very much, John.
Oh, thank you too. And yeah, we can do this. Well, thank you, Dr. Daniel Clem. And for all my listeners out there, stay dirty and save birds.
Dirty Bird Podcast is brought to you by me, John, with my rotating panel of guests and co-hosts. Thanks for being on the show, everybody. The Dirty Bird theme song is by Ricky Pistone. Check out his groovy and hilarious music videos on YouTube. The outro music you're listening to right now is a song, New York Redneck, by the Sidewalk Slammers. Check them out wherever you get your music. The Dirty Bird Podcast logo is by the very talented TJ Ranosky. And of course, a shout out to my beautiful wife, Lauren, who created my original logo. Check out the show notes for this episode for a full list of credits for any bird calls or sounds used in the episode. Thanks for listening.
Jungle, I might get into a little rumble.